Izzy said that there could be inflation in a hyper-Bitcoinized world. And she's right. Calm down, Maxis, calm down. Explaining why this is true sheds light on yet another of Bitcoin's quasi-magical properties and paints our hyper-Bitcoinized future an even rosier shade of orange. This is good for Bitcoin. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. We have got a fun lineup, a bunch of different shows coming on the horizon here. I'm working on many. I've got a list of like 10 that I'm really excited to get to. A couple of longer reads, some things about Satoshi's emails and such, which I'm currently in think about mode and figuring out how to, how would even delivering that, in what form would that make sense? If anybody has any bright ideas, but I know probably a bunch of people would like to listen to or scour through that archive, so to speak. So I'm going to try to make it available in some way, if possible. A bunch of other stuff. And right now, today, with this episode that is brought to you by Swan Bitcoin, the place to buy Bitcoin and to plug your entire financial life into a Bitcoin standard. And then, of course, CoinKite, the makers of the Cold Card hardware wallet, who are going to keep that shit safe by keeping your keys off of insecure devices. And my discount code is now 10%. Special links for both, and my discount code will be right in the show notes. We have a really fun little read from Alan Farrington, which is old. It's old. It's like 3 years ago old. July 2021, so not quite 3 years ago, like 2 years and 7 months or something. But the piece itself is not really relevant to, it's timeless in the sense that it is just talking about the absurdity and the kind of tautology of the velocity of money equation, which sounds very boring economics, but it's not, and it's a very fun piece. And it's more about really why the fiat brain is just shriveled and sad, and you don't want to. This is your brain on fiat, kids. Don't do fiat. But it also is an important lesson on the differences between monetary inflation and price inflation, and why the very simple-minded Bitcoiner out there will just scream that inflation can never happen on a Bitcoin standard. And why that is actually not true, and what that actually tells us about a hyper-Bitcoinized world. And I think you're going to like it. So with that, let's jump right into today's read. And it's titled, Inflation in a Hyper-Bitcoinized World by Alan Farrington. A little cheeky brainstorm on the methodological individualism of price inflation and capital formation. Oh my god, guys, we recorded our clubhouse for once. What a glorious moment for culture and humanity. Thanks to the good folks at Swan Bitcoin, Alex Fetsky and I spoke to Isabella Kaminska for some ridiculous amount of time until we fell asleep at 2:15 a.m. or so. Once we level up our competence yet again and turn it into a podcast, you will be able to verify the following for yourselves. But for the time being, you will have to trust me. Izzy said that there could be inflation in a hyper-Bitcoinized world. Wait, what? And she's right. What the f***? Calm down, Maxis, calm down. Explaining why this is true sheds light on yet another of Bitcoin's quasi-magical properties and paints our hyper-Bitcoinized future an even rosier shade of orange. This is good for Bitcoin. I kinda thought I had explained this well enough in the Capital Strip Mine, but then again, it's like super long and people are busy, so I'll try to keep this one under a 10-minute read. Narrator: He failed. Inflation, by virtue of being an economic phenomenon, has two different kinds of explanation: methodologically individualist ones and wrong ones. The wrong one is the degenerate fiat economics trope we are witnessing in real time as lumber go up, yet numbers stay down. I'm not going to waste any of your time explaining the machinations in which central bank economists are willing to engage to keep the number down, because I also don't even really care. It's Brandolini's law once again, and I happen to simply not have orders of magnitude more energy than they do. The methodologically individualist explanation requires an important distinction between price inflation and supply inflation. Central bankers are aware of this too, clearly. The entire point of their machinations is to try to convince you the two have nothing to do with one another and everything is under control because they think you are stupid. But you aren't stupid, are you? You know that inflation of the money supply happens in fiat terms whenever a bank creates a loan ex nihilo without ever writing off a previous credit asset on a net basis, or when the central bank creates new reserves ex nihilo. You also know that this happens in Bitcoin never. So what is Izzy talking about? Is she a useful idiot of the chattering classes, as I confessed in Clubhouse to once having called her? No, Izzy is based AF, and she's not stupid either. She knows she is talking about price inflation, how much stuff costs. Can the price of stuff ever go up in a hyper-Bitcoinized world? Yes. Here's how. To capture Izzy's idea in degenerate fiat speak, we would say, quote, an increase in velocity. And it's worth explaining exactly why this is so silly before describing the same thing in plain English. As Mises knew well, quote, velocity is pretty stupid. And as Saylor has said of such other pretty stupid aggregates as GDP growth and CPI, it is a metaphysical abstraction. It comes from Fisher's equation of exchange from the quantity theory of money, usually simply written as MV equals PT. This has the curious characteristic of not really being an equation, but rather a tautology, a definition, and a destroyer of useful information. It's really quite bizarre. What it actually says is that, quote, velocity is defined as PQ divided by M, or everything bought in a year times its price divided by the money supply. But were we minded to behave more like physicists, i.e. real scientists, than economists, i.e. not real scientists, we could do some cheeky dimensional analysis on this equation and start off by leaving out V entirely. Let's just call it question mark because it could be anything. Who knows? We might make a discovery. So question mark equals PQ divided by M. Now, the dimension of P is dollars. It's the average price of all the stuff. And M is also dollars, the total amount of money. So they can cancel. But we will wait just a moment before doing that. Q is a super weird variable. It allegedly means quantity, as in how many of the things were sold at the average price P that year. Why does that matter? It seems dimensionless, so it really doesn't. The Wikipedia page above is unintentionally hilarious on trying to explain this away, by the way. But actually, what it is really there for is, quote, that year, meaning it gives us the dimensions of 1 divided by time, as in how many per year. So P times Q becomes how much money was spent on stuff in a year. Dividing by M leaves us with just 1 divided by time to equal question mark? How many of something per year? How many of what? Believe it or not, there isn't really an answer that refers to the real world, despite all the inputs being apparently real. The problem is we have multiplied up an average, apparently solely for the sake of dimensional consistency, then divided it by something of the same units but to which it bears no real-world relation. What is left over for the question mark to, quote, explain is how many times did the average dollar get spent? Let's call that velocity, because why not? It sounds like it's about speed. It's not a vector, but we are well past any of this making sense, so who cares? quote, velocity has been tautologically defined. Yippee! But it tells us absolutely nothing, because there is no, quote, average price, and hence there is no, quote, average dollar. The average dollar is a metaphysical abstraction, or to quote Mises, what? Velocity? You serious, bruh? All this averaging and abstracting obscures that all of this happens across time. What is being captured here is dynamic, but the equation of exchange implies, without ever being too explicit, that these quantities just exist as features of the universe. The degenerate fiat economist would say, velocity went up, when what he really meant was persons X, Y, and Z made decisions to spend more for reasons A, B, and C. Or crucially, if asked to explain, quote, inflation, any attempt will be next to incomprehensible. Let's evaluate the options. 1. Velocity went up. Meaningless. 2. Quantity went down. Huh? No, seriously, what does this mean? Here we finally pay for the mistake of including a variable that does nothing beyond throw 1 divided by time into the mix to balance the dimensions, but otherwise has no clear way to be understood in real terms. 3. Money supply went up. Sounds appealing at first glance, but for example, does this mean state money increased or bank money, credit or equity? If unbacked credit has been created ex nihilo, as fiat bankers are wont to do, how do we distinguish this from velocity? Is it even possible to hold velocity constant and point purely to the money supply? Doesn't that require some even more confusing offset somewhere else? The mind, it boggles. And 4, price level went up. Wait, what? Isn't that exactly what we are asking? Yes, but it gets even more confusing because P is the average price, which tells us absolutely nothing if we want to know about a specific price. Let's scrap this nonsense and go with the Farrington theory of price instead, which I just made up right at this moment. Price equals the money spent on stuff divided by stuff available to be bought. This is consciously descriptive of the aggregate level of, quote, stuff, such that a price might give some useful measure of inflation, but unlike the Fisher what do you call it above, we can easily translate this to the price of an individual good or service. Price of a good equals money spent on that good divided by the amount of that good available to be bought. This has the benefit of being both simpler and more accurate in terms of what it captures. It's a gloriously elegant model. It's basically science. It may even be the science. Trademark. This now ties back very nicely to my much longer explanation in the capital strip mine. Given price inflation is not a metaphysical abstraction, but comes from individuals making decisions and acting, it is now pretty clear what decisions and actions lead to inflation. When the money being spent on a good goes up, or when the amount of that good available goes down. Notice, this is saying very little more than either demand went up or supply went down. This is a very good sign, given that this is literally all of economics in one sentence. The tiny bit more it is saying helpfully hints at why either or both of these has happened. The merchant will have a window of time in which she expects to sell the amount in her inventory before then expecting to restock. If she gets through her stock faster than this and still has more inquiries she cannot meet, or if she has the same number of inquiries but gets through her stock quicker because there is less to begin with, then she will decide, she will act, to increase prices to boost her margins, boost her returns, and better clear the market. And there you have it, price inflation. Customers decided for reasons to buy more stuff, and the merchant decided for reasons to raise prices. Methodological individualism, 1. Metaphysical abstractions, 0. I mentioned above that the Fisher, what do you call it, gets very confused about the different kinds of money supply growth. We can now be a little more specific, because the Farrington theory of price doesn't address this either. Is this a flaw in my Nobel Memorial-worthy theory? LOL, of course not. The difference is the Fisher equation pretends to capture this. And then when you try to work through the implications of varieties of monetary inflation, you just end up confused. Mine doesn't even try because, drumroll, to the individual, it doesn't matter. The merchant does not say to herself, "Well, gee whiz, I sure would like to raise prices and boost margins and increase returns, but I can't for the life of me tell if the money being spent on stuff faster than before has come from unbacked credit creation by banks, from central bank reserve creation, from customers dipping into their savings, from my competitors going out of business, or some combination of all four, or possibly more. What a pickle." She just sees the change and reacts. This is a perfect example, incidentally, of the one sensible way in which markets can be considered, quote, efficient, with respect to information. She doesn't need to know the answer because she has been given the pure, condensed signal of customer behavior, into which all the relevant information has been compressed. She knows how to act in response, without needing to know why. The Fisher equation has special difficulty with the final two options considered, dipping into savings and the competitive landscape shifting, because these are distinctly local events that cannot be explained within an aggregate or an average. This all gets nicely to Izzy's point. You absolutely can have inflation in a hyper-Bitcoinized world, and the Farrington theory of price makes it totally obvious why. There are two possible reasons. Stuff bought goes down. Not that interesting as likely indicative of a natural disaster, but for the sake of argument, let's suppose we are in the wake of a credit crunch in which previously misallocated capital is being liquidated and less is being produced in the interim. This also won't happen in a hyper-Bitcoinized world, but just humor me, will ya? Or money spent goes up. This is the trap.
It's a trap!
The terribly, terribly silly Bitcoiner answer here is to scream 21 million until somebody calls the police for breaching the peace. The sophisticated Bitcoiner will realize there are all sorts of reasons money spent could go up that, given they do not result from an expansion of the base money supply, because 21 million, you idiot, are worth thinking about more carefully to see what, if anything, they reveal. Izzy's idea was straightforward enough, and I alluded to it above. People start to dip into their savings to spend. For any confused, not-quite-Bitcoiner readers, quote, savings is an antiquated concept whereby you earn money and then don't spend it. No, seriously, you just don't. You leave it alone, and then you have the option to spend it in the future. No, seriously, because in a hyper-Bitcoinized world, there won't be a bottomless pit of consumer credit, so if you want the option to spend in the future, you will have to save. It basically means not spend right now, but it has fewer letters and syllables. But actually, patterns of investment could affect this dynamic in a more complicated way. Bitcoin Tina and I, and implicitly Seyfried Amos too, but we've never all talked about it together, have a fascinating disagreement about to what extent, if any, credit will exist on a Bitcoin standard. Tina thinks none, I think some, but neither of us can, quote, prove it, obviously, so we just have to yell at each other in Clubhouse while we wait to see. We did so in Izzy's episode. It was fire. In any case, credit would be the easiest to understand version of my following point, but is by no means the only one that works. Imagine literally any temporally discordant boost in capital investment. Perhaps this could also just be a more roundabout version of, quote, dipping into savings. People snap out of their Scroogey miserdom and realize that if we just rely on deflationary money to provide for us, we will literally all starve and die within a week or two, and they shift their liquid capital into illiquid capital accumulation. You don't even really need to think about this too hard. That investment could go towards all kinds of things, likely mostly novel capital goods, but also real estate, wages, financing services. Bankers need a cut too, obvs, which will quickly filter to regular people looking to consume. Or, quote, save. By any number of channels which, as good methodological individualists, we don't need to pretend to understand, money spent will go up. Merchants will react in order to maximize their returns. inflation.
Boo! Boo hiss! Bitcoin is deflationary! 21 million! 21 million!
Just wait. Just wait. What happens next is key, and unfortunately spoils what I thought was the most interesting bit of the entire podcast, besides Izzy's musings on the future of biowarfare. Don't quit before you get to that part, faux show. What happens next invites, arguably demands, clarity on the typical capital structure post-hyperbitcoinization. And this is where Tina's and my disagreement really becomes clear, as rather more aesthetic than practically consequential. If there is debt in such a world, there is a very, very small amount, at least relative to now. So with either zero debt or very little debt, entrepreneurs will be in a position to react to these price signals with maximum flexibility. Contrast this to degenerate fiat finance, in which the answer to every question is more unbacked credit. Stock market volatility? More unbacked credit. Repo market liquidity crunch? More unbacked credit. Too much unbacked credit? More unbacked credit. Tea or coffee? More unbacked credit. But in a hyper-Bitcoinized world, the answer will be, well, I frankly have no idea, because it will emerge from methodologically individualist entrepreneurs acting from flexible balance sheets and no longer politically misaligned incentives. But one thing I can say relatively confidently is that any, quote, inflation will be short-lived. It will only serve to reflect some unexpected change in economic reality that it requires a reallocation of capital to satisfy. But unlike in degenerate fiat finance, it will not either be the product of or itself be permanentized inflation from unbacked credit that will never be redeemed. It will actually be healthy inflation, because the underlying money or stuff situation will be real and will demand it. In the moment, that is. In anything longer than the very, very short, basically instantaneous run, entrepreneurs will deflate it away again with effective capital allocation that identifies, responds to, and improves upon this new reality. This all provides yet another, far more roundabout and conceptual route to explain the idiocy of, quote, velocity. To the extent the variable means anything at all, it is entirely endogenous and has no causal import. So it emerges from a range of other behavior and doesn't then affect any behavior. To take it seriously is to be deeply confused. But what else is new? The end. Listen to the podcast when it comes out. Peace and love. Alan Farrington. This episode is brought to you by CoinKite and the Cold Card Hardware Wallet, which, by the way, you can now get 10% off with my code Bitcoin Audible. The little quirk of the 9%, only 9% off has actually been corrected. I'm not sure if it was like an update, but they just let me know. We now have a full 10% off with my discount code Bitcoin Audible. And also, I would appreciate the couple of people who reached out and let me know that the code was being quirky there for a minute. It is all sorted. So if you're looking to pick up your Mark IV now, go to the show notes. The link is right there. The code works. It is Bitcoin Audible, all one word, and you will get a 10% discount. And you know, I want you to, for anybody who doesn't know and hasn't explored the Cold Card and just kind of the hardware devices from CoinKite in general, I want you to just go to coldcard.com. They have the website, and it's basically just a breakdown of what the Cold Card Mark IV can do and what the device is like. And I want you to remember that you can just tap this to your phone to transmit information and sign a transaction. And I want you to appreciate, A, how much fun that is, but also how great the UX is when you're dealing with Bitcoin and you're dealing specifically with securely holding your keys off of your phone, but you still want to be able to quickly access your Bitcoin wallet. That option is off by default for security reasons, but it's just my favorite way to do mobile Bitcoin, and I highly recommend it just because it's such a great setup, and it gets this kind of sweet spot of like seriously secure keys, but then also really fun and simple to use. So take a second, go to coldcard.com, and then when you inevitably decide that you need one, get 10% off with code BitcoinAudible. It will all be right there in the show notes because I support accessibility. All right, so Alan Farrington sent me this piece just the other day, just because it was relevant to a conversation we were having on Twitter. And I'm pretty sure I read this back when it was posted, but I had forgotten about it and I'd never read it on the show. And I think this is an important distinction in understanding inflation or price inflation, the separation between price inflation and monetary inflation. And it's also, as Alan's writing often is, really fun. But the thing that I think it does really well is the breakdown and explanation. I mean, Mises always had a great explanation, and I feel like I've covered it at some point on this show. I know I did a guy's take where I broke down the whole velocity nonsense. But I feel like this does a really good job of... Because I did it from a more of a, like, well, what would you actually pull apart in the equation? Like, how would you find each of these individual pieces? And if you break down, which one is it? P, Q? I think it's like Q. You literally need velocity. Like one of the things is velocity. So, like, it is a tautology even when you just do it out like math, like a as if you're quote-unquote physics. But it's such a great example of the whole physics envy because this equation doesn't make any sense, and it's not something that you can use to calculate anything. There's not even any such thing as the average price. And then the quote, how much stuff has been sold per year, is also meaningless because what are we talking about? How many houses or how many paper clips? There's no like aggregate stuff that is of any consequence. You know, like if you sell one iPhone instead of a speaker, a calculator, a pencil, a notepad, and a calendar, and like these, you know, 300 physical things that it replaces. What does that mean for velocity? Did velocity go down? But what's even more hilarious is when you really break down what it's pretending to try to make sense of, is the fact that demand can change very quickly. Is that you can have a period where people aren't interested in buying a thing, and then that demand can go up. Or you can have a period where there is high demand, and then that demand can fall, which basically makes the idea of velocity not a thing and not useful at all. We're just talking about normal supply and demand and adding in an element of time, which there should have always been an element of time. It's not really necessary to add it in like it's something special or you did something different. It's just supply and demand. It's just basic economics. And what it is literally attempting to do, the reason I think it's so compelling to the fiat degenerate economics or those of the political economist persuasion, is that it actually obscures all of the central bank unbacked money printing and unbacked credit creation and all of these parasitic practices of the political regime and the banking and finance structure of the fiat world, and tries to like hide it behind or equate it to just normal and temporal, like just sudden spurts of changes in either supply or demand. It's trying to conflate them so that the unbacked credit creation and the endless amounts of money printing doesn't seem like something odd, because it's just important about what the velocity of money is doing. We can do a bunch of unbacked credit, but, you know, who knows what happened with supply and demand? Maybe velocity will go down. We got to fix it. And as Farrington obviously made clear, the answer and solution to all problems of all kinds in economic and political life is more unbacked credit. But even more towards like Mises's point around the velocity of money and why it's kind of absurd is the idea that there's even a difference between, quote, circulating and idle money, because there isn't. It's just money is being possessed at all times. It's only in an instantaneous moment that it's being exchanged for some other good. And that's what makes it a totem for society. That's what makes it a easy thing to compare, because it's just the biggest good. Like that's all it is. It's just the most... Like, so you're just saying that people want to exchange one good for another good. At the end of the day, that's always what's happening. Money is just another good. It's simply a network good. And because it is so liquid, it makes it a great reference point or comparison point, and all you're doing is in the act of engaging in trading and making an exchange itself is you're setting the comparison. You're saying that this is underpriced or overpriced. That's it. You're saying that because there's, as a group, we collectively value money less than this new thing, therefore its price goes up, or really more, therefore we purchase it. We trade our money away to get the good in, or we hold the money or don't trade our goods for it because we don't think it's worth it, and therefore the price has to drop. So if there's any theory about the value, the velocity, or the purchasing power of money that's trying to account for anything, it must like foundationally start from the relational value of these two things and their relevant supplies and demands, because that's the whole thing is supply and demand. I mean, Alan Farrington says it in this piece, it's supply or demand. It's either a change in one or the other. And that's basically economics in one sentence, the supply and demand. That's it. You don't need all of this other convoluted nonsense. All you need from there is to deduce what people do, why people make decisions, and what they see, and what the consequences of the value, the relative values of all of those things really is. But of course, price inflation, in the absence of monetary inflation, in the context of like something like Bitcoin, and you know, for anybody who is ever in this sort of debate, I hope you are able and aware to make this caveat or recognize this difference, because it is important. And the Keynesian and the fiat degenerate economist is going to try to conflate the two to trap you in the fact that, like, oh, well, there is inflation everywhere. And what they intend to do is excuse away the fact that $6 trillion got printed and the price of everything got doubled. And they want to say, well, yo, if it's only 21 million, stuff will still, it's not, it moves, stuff moves, wind blows. And it's like, yes, of course, supply and demand will change. But guess what won't happen? The available money supply won't suddenly double in a permanent way such that it can never be pulled back in. And the general price floor of all things will also double, because it's got nothing to do with the that's what makes a good money, a sound money, able to actually measure all of this stuff, is because the supply is generally or extremely close to stable. Thus, we get to measure what happens to demand? What happens to the supply of the other goods in relation to it? Trying to measure this shit in fiat that's got trillions of unbacked credit being made is like trying to measure a house with a tape measure that is actually just like thin ribbon. Like it's not stiff and it doesn't hook on anything. It's just like a thin ribbon, and it's blowing. It's always blowing in like a 30-mile-an-hour wind. But back to Alan Farrington's point, because I just want to help illustrate what he's trying to get across in this and make it really, really simple to understand. Or maybe picture just as an example that you may have seen in your life. So what does it mean that the price, and not, again, not monetary inflation. I really, really wish we had separate words for these things. Not monetary inflation, but price inflation. The fact that prices have tended to or have suddenly or at any time changed, not because, well, for any reason, because of monetary inflation or because of supply changing or demand changing. So a good example for demand has changed and supply is static or does not fulfill the sudden new demand. So let's say there's a set amount of demand relative to PlayStations on the market. Then PlayStation comes out with, what are we even on? It's like PlayStation 5 right now, I guess. They come out with a PlayStation 6, and it's like a huge breakthrough. It's super great, and they can only print like 100,000 or maybe 1 million units on their first run or something, and they have massive pre-sales. Well, what happens after they basically run out? They run out of their pre-sale really fast. Well, what happens is the PlayStations get resold on the market. You get people selling it on eBay, on Craigslist, you know, all these resale markets on Amazon even, and they'll sell it, you know, the PlayStation 6 is normally like $499 and they're selling it for $700. They're selling it for $800. And let's say this happens and the monetary inflation, there's no new unbacked credit being issued, there's no money printing, new reserves, no nothing. Like, this is purely just high demand for the PlayStation 6 that outweighs the supply in the short term of its launch. The price could still go up. There could still be inflation in PlayStation 6s. But Sony is specifically going to increase the supply in order to bring that price back down. And the resellers will not be able to sell it for $700, $800, $1,000 for very long. So what the Farrington theory of price will indicate to us, or will encourage us to do, is recognize that what has happened is there is some sort of the price of the now equilibrium price of PlayStation 6s in all markets in which it is available is high, and now we have to ask what has happened. Was the stuff that was available decreased, or is there now more money able to spend on this thing than the stuff is available? So it just comes back to, okay, during this period, what is happening with supply and demand? And let's look at it to figure out what the dynamics are. It just gives you a framework, just a basic supply and demand. It gives you a framework to assess what the market is doing and assess what needs to be hunted for in order to find the relevant details and the information in the market that kind of can explain what these things happened. Obviously, our relevant information here is the fact that Sony launched a new PlayStation and they did not have as much supply as all of the people who had savings ready and able to buy the new PlayStation. So the aftermarket, the secondary market prices went up. There was inflation. And yes, that can happen on a Bitcoin standard or a fiat standard. It doesn't matter. But what fiat standards are also going to have is the, you printed $6 trillion out of thin air and you issued $3 trillion of new unbacked credit and the price of everything doubled everywhere and our standard of livings fell because all of our savings got wiped out. That only happens on the poverty paper standard, not the Bitcoin standard. And I would also add, just for a little evil, dumb technicality fun, is there are two other ways that Bitcoin price inflation could happen in a hyper-Bitcoinized world, is if there is a critical and system-breaking bug or failure of the cryptography in the Bitcoin system, and then also if there is an asteroid that blows up half the planet or maybe nuclear war. So you know, but actually, inflation can happen in a hyper-Bitcoinized world. You know, I think one of the big takeaways, or the ridiculous takeaways, but also very indicative of the way that Keynesians and kind of the political economic theater thinks about economics, like their framing and why it's wrong, is that their assessment, like when it comes to the velocity of money equation here, is that they kind of seem to try to take humans out of the equation altogether, as if humans are just kind of like these annoying things that don't line up to their equations. It's always like blame the people for it not working, as if rational decisions and value judgments and trade-offs in the market and the incentives of the actual people are just like this nuisance that won't do what their perfect equations clearly indicate they should do. Which is hilarious, because the whole point of economics is simply to describe and understand economic decisions and value judgments and rational comparisons and trade-offs. And that's the thing that they keep wanting to take out, because they've got their perfect model for what reality should be, and they're going to make it happen, and they don't care how much unbacked credit created out of thin air from nothing they need to make in order to make sure it does what it's supposed to do. So anyway, I just thought this was a fun one and a great way to start off the week. Shout out to Alan Farrington. I don't think he had any idea I was going to read this on the show. I was just bored yesterday, like over the weekend, and I was like, oh, that's right. He sent me a little thing to read, and I like read a couple of articles, and that was one of them. I was like, this is fun. We should definitely do an episode on this. So I've got a lot of great stuff coming, a couple of really good reads, and actually a new show type is on the way. One that I don't want to hint at too much yet because we're setting things up for it. But I think you guys are really, really going to enjoy this one. I know I am going to have a lot of fun, so stay tuned. Also, don't forget to check out the YouTube channel. I've got some memes in the works, so I am getting back into action on that one. Some other video stuff happening in the background. Also, AI Unchained is up there on the YouTube channel. And then, of course, on the other podcast feed, you can always find those links right there in the show notes. And, of course, to our amazing sponsors, a shout-out, a thank you, a much love to Swan Bitcoin and CoinKite. Swan, the place to buy your Bitcoin, and CoinKite, which is where you're going to find out how to keep it safe. And I want you to do something for me. It's a very simple thing. I want you to share an episode of this podcast out, one that you like, because this show has grown entirely by word of mouth, and it is the easiest way and best way for you to support this show. So follow, subscribe, and share it out. I am Guy Swan. This is Bitcoin Audible. And until next time, everybody, take it easy, guys. It's the questions we can't answer that teach us the most. They teach us how to think. If you give a man an answer, all he gains is a little fact. But give him a question, and he'll look for his own answers. Patrick Rothfuss, The Wise Man's Fear.